Welcome to Wine for Normal People, the podcast for people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. I'm your host, Elizabeth Schneider, author of the Wine for Normal People book and certified wine dork. You hear me talk about Wine Access every week. Now is the time. If you were on the fence before, you got to join the Wine for Normal People Wine Access Wine Club by going to wineaccess.com/normal for a limited time. Join the club and get $25 off your first two shipments. That's $125 per shipment for six bottles, 10% off all other Wine Access purchases when you join the club. Let me pick out some wine for you. Go to wineaccess.com/normals. Listen in the middle of the show for more details. My friend Brian Callahan of Crux in Sonoma has decided that he is going to tell us the real story behind how a vineyard works. He is a small vineyard owner. He has a vineyard at his house. And I asked him, begged him, give us a real look at what happens in the vineyard to get good grapes and make the awesome wine that Crux makes. Brian talks to me all the time about, you know, what he does in the vineyard, what he's doing on a day-to-day basis. And the wines are so good. I asked him about this and he said, well, I've only been doing this for 18 years and I'm not really sure if that's enough and blah, blah, blah. Get out of here, Brian. We're going to go through the year and you are going to tell us what actually happens in the vineyards. What is true? Because a lot of people have asked me about this. What is the year in the vineyard? And so you're going to take us through that. And thank you. And I kind of think 18 years has gotten you the 10,000 hours of expertise. Sorry.
Well, thanks, Elizabeth. I'm super happy to be here. The pleasure is all of mine. Like I told you, I'm not a student of viticulture, but I have learned it in practice. And between Steve and I, and we do have a couple guys that help us out when we need a little talent and timing coordination to get our dormant pruning done. They help us with harvest because those are big tasks. And the two of us would take a lot longer than the four of us.
It's still only four people, let's face it. It's not right. Like you've got an army of people. That's why you're perfect for this.
Well, we're farming 3 acres that we, Steve and I, planted ourselves between 2005 and 2007. We grow six different varietals. We're in the middle reach of the Russian River Valley, so just south of Healdsburg. In the transitional zone, that's kind of where Crux came from. We're physically in the Russian River Valley, but have characteristics of Chalk Hill and Dry Creek and Alexander Valley. They all come together in the confluence of right where our vineyards are. So we are in the Crux.
And your six varieties are?
We grow Viognier, Grenache, Syrah, Petite Syrah, Mourvedre, and a little bit of Zinfandel.
Rhone, Rhone, Rhone. All right, we're going to do the calendar. I want you to take us through winter. You've just finished this. We're recording this in spring. But the cycle starts with pruning, right? You mentioned pruning. When do you do this? Like, what are you trying to do? What tools do you use? What do you do? And it's a lot harder than people think. Can you talk about the whole process of pruning?
The winter months are really the slowest in the vineyard, and there's the least for us to do because after harvest, usually we get our first frost in maybe December when it starts to get cold and the vineyards go into dormancy. And they sleep and they're really kind of recovering from last year's vintage and storing up energy for next year's harvest. So usually in the February, March timeframe, things start to warm up a little bit. For us as small vineyards, I mean, it takes us a couple of days to do our dormant pruning. We go in to the vineyards and cut off last year's new growth. The grapes only grow or develop off of new wood. So it's a little bit akin to a rose bush where you're cutting back the new wood and setting up the vineyard for growth for the next harvest.
When you harvest, you're just taking off the grapes and you leave everything else on there. You're done. You take what you need and then you just say, have a great sleep, vine.
Yep. We don't do any cutting of vines during the winter. Just the canopy is probably already shutting down at the time we harvest the fruit, but the grape leaves turn red and yellow and beautiful colors and they fall off like a tree. So you just got a bunch of sticks in the vineyard afterwards.
So you have these skeletal looking vines when you go to prune. Yep. What exactly is pruning? For somebody who knows nothing about pruning and thinks a prune is a dried plum, like tell me.
Okay.
Tell me what it is and like what kind of decisions you have to make when you're looking at this plant in front of you.
We use a fairly common trellising method. It's called VSP or vertical shoot positioning. And we use what they call a bilateral cordon. So the trunk comes up from the ground, and then there's a split, which they call the crown. And then we've got two arms that are called cordons that go right and left. There's lots of other ways to trellis your vineyard, but that's probably the most common vineyard technique. So you've got a single fruit zone, like all the fruit is in one place. So the cordons, you develop that infrastructure over the first couple of years of a vineyard by way you're training and trimming the vines. So that trunk and cordon structure is basically permanent, and you're cutting the new growth back to that point every year. So on each cordon, which are the right and left arms, you develop spurs, and this we've got like 4 to 6 spurs on each arm of the vine. And basically you're going in when you're pruning and you're cutting those shoots that have grown off the spurs from last vintage.
So the spurs are like little buds that shoot up little branches, right?
Yeah, it's like a little node on top of the thing, and you can see where the buds would form. You're basically cutting the spur back to one bud.
For all of them.
Yep. And then you take the wood that you've just cut. We just pull it out of the trellis, and it's got wire, so it's kind of stuck in there and may have tendrils that have attached to the trellis wire. So you're pulling that out. We just leave them in the vineyard because when we come in the spring to cut down our cover crops, we use a mower that's called a flail mower that goes behind the tractor. It has little blades on it that cuts the grass as well as mulches, so it cuts it up into small pieces. So we just grind up the canes that we have cut out of dormant pruning, and it just chops them up and they decompose into the vineyard. So we're just trying to return that material back into the vineyard, and
that's good for the humus, right?
Correct.
What about different grapes? I mean, you have 6 different varieties, so do you have to prune things in different ways?
No, our trellis system's the same, so if the goal is pretty much the same. And again, if we had a different kind of trellis system, we would do it a little differently. We try to wait as late as possible. We're hoping that we have gotten past the last frost before we do dormant pruning. So this year we did it in mid-March, which is a little later than, not later than last year. Last year was super late.
Wasn't it cold?
Was really cold here last year. This year has not been as cold, but it's been wet. We're in fact supposed to get 1 inch of rain on Saturday, which is not typical in May.
So would you worry about rot now?
Yes, it does add mold pressure into the later growing season. It's probably not something, unless we have a deluge or a downpour or hail, a little bit of rain is not going to be a big issue. I mean, the vines are 4 to 6 inches tall at this point. There isn't fruit set yet, so we're not worried about flowers or bloom or anything like that.
So you prune everything. How long does it take to do your whole vineyard?
You can move pretty expeditiously. In total, we have about 3,000 vines. It takes a couple of minutes a vine.
Your vines are getting older, so are the older vines needing as much care, or are they less vigorous so you don't have to worry about pruning as much?
We have to prune every vine. Right. Regardless of its age. The year before last, I did a replant of about, I don't know, it was almost 20% of the vineyard because of, you know, we went through some serious years of drought.
Yep.
So I had vines that have died. So those new vines, I'm still in the process of training into the trunk and cordon mode. So we're not getting fruit off those yet, but there's still work to be done, even for those non-producing vines, just to make sure the infrastructure is solid.
Can anything go wrong while you're pruning?
Sure.
Tell us about that.
You're trying to make the most intelligent decision that you can. And you're looking at the vine and you're seeing the two canes that grew from last year. The best choice is to pick the lowest part of the spur to leave that for the new growth. Because if you pick the highest spur, the vine keeps rising in height over time, and that creates some sort of imbalance. But you want to pick the best suited vine for the next season. So you want to look at its direction. You want to look at its health. So you're just kind of making quick snap decisions. And 9 times out of 10, it's a fairly obvious decision. So there's only a moment you might have to pause and decide what you're going to do.
If you make the wrong decision, what happens?
Either it's a vine that is out of step with the rest of the vineyard, which either means you take it out early so you're not dealing with it and wait till next year. I mean, it's not the whole vine, it's usually just a shoot within a vine, you know, so it's a 5% impact in terms of a yield. And that's probably at the high perspective. The vines are pretty forgiving. You can't screw it up so bad, you're not going to get any sort of harvest.
If you were huge and you were a big industrial vineyard, how do they prune? Do they still do it by hand or do they do it in other ways? Do you know?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I think mechanization has certainly taken a stronger foothold. The technology has gotten better, but it's a manpower situation, whether it's the guy driving the tractor or the guys out there doing the pruning. We have vineyards in our area that are large commercial operations that start pruning in December. And
Oh my
that's because they've
gosh.
got so many acres to get through before spring.
Does that affect the vines at all or not really? I mean,
Sure.
they're
I mean,
dormant, no?
it exposes them differently to the elements, to whatever happens that winter. If you have a fresh cut on a vine, it's more susceptible to disease.
We didn't talk about the wounds. You're cutting, so you're exposing wood.
Yep.
And so that means that things can get in if you do it at the wrong time. If you do it a little bit later, then things are already processing throughout the vine, so it has a chance to sort of heal up more.
The pruning doesn't spring the vine into life. It'll still be dormant. You'll just have that fresh cut exposed for a longer period of time, which increases your risk. So when we're doing pruning at the last minute, I mean, we're starting to see swelling buds in the vines when we do it. And so you cut, and sometimes you get immediate water welling up on that new cut just because the vines are starting to come to life. And we're looking at the cuts to see. I mean, one of the diseases we have seen is called Eutypa, which is like a trunk disease. And when
Die
you make the,
back, right? You type a die back, it dies, right?
they used to call it dead arm. Then you're not supposed
Yes.
to call it dead arm anymore, but
Why?
well, I don't know.
Kind of is, though, isn't it? I mean, you
Well,
could,
sure.
yeah, a
And that's where
whole
one of the
part of the
chordons
trunk is just gonna
will
die.
die. But when you make the cut and you're looking at the fresh cut, you should see it's kind of like a brown dot in the middle of green pulpy stuff on the outside of the vine. And if there's usually a wedge-shaped, darker colored brown that goes to the outside and is in the place where that green circle should be, that's a sign of Eutypa. We saw it originally in the first couple of years, but I think we've done pretty well to eradicate it. I mean, it could come back, and you basically have to cut that vine back until you don't see that darkened wood area. And then sometimes that means you're cutting all the way down to the trunk and you kind of have to start over.
Ooh, well, if it prevents the disease from spreading, I guess you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. And all that wood you have to remove from the vineyard. We wouldn't put those canes into the vineyard because they have live spores and you want to get them out so they're not infecting other vines.
You have to be able to recognize that. I would not be able to recognize that. So
Well,
you
it would
obviously have
take
to have
you two vines
experience.
to figure it out. If we showed you a picture, it's very easily identifiable.
Okay. What about soil? So now all of the wood is on the ground. Don't you have to care for the soil? Like some people till, some people are anti-till now. Some people weed, some people don't weed, some people cover crop, some people don't. When do you do all of this? Why are some people so against tilling and things like
Everybody's got an opinion. I mean,
that?
if you're tilling, it means you've got a tractor out in the vineyard, you're burning fossil fuels, you're compacting the soil, which is part of it. We have done selective tilling in terms of managing the soil. So after we pick the vineyards in the fall, I usually put the water on right afterwards because it's sort of shocking to the vines to have the fruit removed. And then I usually add compost around the vine base before the winter. And we use compost from all the byproducts from the winery come back to my vineyard. I've got three different compost piles from 23, 22, 21 that are currently in various degrees of decay. I add things to it to
Enrich it.
increase, yeah, just the diversity. We share our building with a coffee roaster. So I get coffee grounds and put those into the compost bins. I've been doing some burning of large trunks that were on our property from trees that have been removed, and that biochar we often stir into the compost to give it more diversity.
When you say it's from the vineyards, is it like the leaves too? Is it what's
I
the
mean, there's some brush, but it's mostly oak and eucalyptus trees that have been removed from the property and not viable really as firewood or for any other purpose. So it's mostly just big trunks
Got it.
that I can't physically move somewhere else. So you kind of got to burn them in place. So we do the composting, we do planting of the cover crop, and that's sort of right after harvest.
How do you decide what cover crop to put in? So in Chianti, for instance, they started putting in fava beans because they felt like it gave more moisture to the soil in dry
Yeah.
points. Do you think about that? You've got to decide what you're going to put as a cover crop.
Yeah, I mean, there's an organic blend that I use pretty much consistently that has a bunch of things. It's peas, it's vetch, it's clover. It's things that they say will fix the nitrogen. I mean, a lot of it is about reinvigorating the nutrients that you've taken out of the soil. We also have mustard that sometimes occurs kind of naturally, but those are all good things that you typically see in the vine rows during a winter in a vineyard. The other thing is, 2 weeks ago, I went through with our flail mower, like I was describing, and cut all that back. I don't remove it, it just sits there and decomposes. And the root systems that the cover crop had are fairly large, so they allow oxygen to penetrate a little deeper into the soil. And it also keeps the weeds away and attracts the bugs that you like to have in your vineyard. I'm pretty lucky. We have a lot of ladybugs in our vineyards just naturally. That's always feels like a good sign to me that we're not at risk of other pests.
Because ladybugs eat them.
Yeah.
Sometimes they release ladybugs.
The Sonoma Agricultural Department will hang like a bug trap in vineyards, especially mine, because I'm a little bit isolated. And even Steve is isolated, but within a few hundred yards of our vineyards, there are several hundred acre vineyards, much larger vineyards. I think that's a target-rich environment. So all the pests seem to go up there and luckily don't seem to find us. Because we get traps pretty much every year. They're looking for the European grapevine moth and other things that would fly into this trap and get caught. So they're always monitoring it, and they've never found anything that's been really invasive for us.
Do you think that's just because you're farming really naturally and the other larger vineyards are probably pretty pesticide rich, let's face it?
Well, I think it's a combination of things, and part of it's luck, and part of it is just our location, and maybe some of it is our practice.
Do you fertilize at all? Do you do it sometimes and not fertilize? Like
A little
fertilize some
bit,
years or
and
not?
it's just kind of a basic nitrogen-rich fertilizer that I put under the emitters. I do it right after we harvest, and then I might do it as the vines get to about a foot tall. I'll add a little bit more fertilizer under the drip line, just to kick nitrogen up a little bit.
You've talked about nitrogen a couple of times. Why is nitrogen so important to the soil?
Well, in terms of photosynthesis and generating the energy that those plants will need to get the grapes ripe, we have had panels done on our soil and our vineyards just to give us a sense of what we're rich in, what we're deficient on, and we're just focusing our nutrient program to support what we get naturally.
Let's talk about the gap between pruning and bud break, where you said you're not there yet, right? And what happens once you start to see buds come out? Do you know if there's a problem? Do you know if it's going to be good? What do you know?
The harvest is undetermined until you pick the grapes.
Of
There,
course.
there's so many failure points that can happen along the way.
Which we will discuss, but let's talk about now.
Well,
Yeah.
yeah, so we get bud break very quickly after we do our dormant pruning because we prune so late. So literally within a week or two, I was seeing buds on all the vines. The younger ones tend to bud out sooner. The older ones are a little further behind. There's not a ton to do at this point. I'm flushing my irrigation lines, and I'll pull my guide wires a little tight, tighten them up a little bit. But I mean, at this time of year, it's kind of when you can watch the vines grow. They grow very fast.
Are you worried at this point in time because of the weather?
I've realized that I can't really do much about it, so there's not much intention of worrying. I mean, we've had a couple mornings where it's gotten around 32, 34 degrees, but it's for like an hour or two. I haven't seen any evidence of frost damage so far. And like I mentioned, the vines are now 4 to 6 inches.
What does frost damage look like?
It's kind of like freezer burn. The leaves get a little brown and kind of wrinkle up, and it's pretty obvious because otherwise they're vibrant and green and spectacular. But they get a little crusty and they almost just fall off the vine.
And if that happens, that's going to limit your yield.
Yeah, well, that vine will not be viable. In all honesty, the vines will probably push another bud, but it will be late. So then you've got variability in your vineyards.
Ugh.
So that's not such a great thing.
Because it's harder to work the vineyard, or because it won't taste the same, or what's the...
It means that vine is that many weeks behind the other vine. So that same deficiency will exist at harvest, and you'll have grapes at various stages of ripeness. I mean, once a couple months goes by, you can't really remember which one was the secondary bud that pushed on that vine. So you either drop it, just means you don't get production out of that shoot, which again, on a percentage basis, isn't that big of a thing. It's a quantity issue.
And it's only an issue if everything gets frost or rot or whatever, then it's a big, big problem.
Yeah. The Europeans seem to have much more risk than we do of that. We're on the bench. We're not in a deep valley where cold typically settles, where you get most of that frost exposure.
There are places in Sonoma that do have that problem, though, aren't there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
They don't like to talk about it, but it's absolutely true. What does humidity do to the vines?
You know, anything in extreme isn't good, whether that's heat or cold, humidity, wind. We don't have a lot of humidity here.
Right. I mean,
there's a few days where it feels a little muggy, but in general, it doesn't have a huge impact for us. But it's the moisture content can create a good environment for powdery mildew and mold and the things that you're trying to keep out of your vineyard.
Let's talk about disease, pest control, mildews, bugs, critters. How do you deal with that? And is it the same every year? Or what are your biggest pest issues? It sounds like you don't have as many as some others in the area, but how do you fight against all of the natural perils and all the things that want to eat your grapes?
Like you said, we don't have a lot of buggy issues. Obviously, if there's an outbreak or if there's a European grape moth mine that's caught in a trap within a circumference of us, we'll get warned and they'll probably give us a protocol to try to mitigate the issue. Powdery mildew is probably our biggest issue, and it's not a huge concern for us. And if you see it in the vineyard, it's probably too late. It means it's already kind of taken over. So we do some preventative spraying, a product. It's a stylet oil. It's a mineral oil-based product that basically suffocates any of the mold spores that can cause damage. We haven't done it yet. We'll probably do it nearing the flowering stage and maybe two or three passes through the vineyard over the course of the year. We have an attachment on the back of the tractor. It's called a pack blast, where we've got a tank with the oil in it, and it's got a big blower fan. So it's got nozzles that go up and down on the back of the tractor and spray the material out. And the blower moves the leaves around so they get evenly coated. It's an organic product. It's not one of the sides. It's not a fungicide or a pesticide.
We should say, I mean, you are not certified organic, but you do mostly work organic, don't you?
Yep.
Yeah. And I actually just did a show on what a pain in the butt it is, especially in the U.S., to become certified, especially for a small vineyard. It just almost doesn't make any sense. So you work the way you work, and the paperwork and the money, and it doesn't do anything really, especially in the U.S. where not being able to use sulfites is just insane. It's a ridiculous prohibition. Here we are. We've done some controls. We pruned. We're watching the bud break, and now flowering happens. So this is about a month after bud break, or 2 months. How quickly after bud break do the grapes start flowering? And the question, we talked about frost, is it worse if it happens during bud break or flowering?
Well, it's never good. so again, it just depends kind of on what degree it happens. So flowering for us is usually like April, May. So we're getting close to flowering. In June, we'll get fruit set. So that in the middle there is kind of when we're trying to spray and protect things. They're the most vulnerable. Our vineyards are not necessarily in lockstep. I mean, the Viognier is always first, and then usually the Syrah or Grenache. Mourvedre is always bringing up the rear. And just in terms of timing the evolution of the growth of the vineyards, but there's not a ton we need to do at this point.
If you get the Wine for Normal People newsletter, which you can sign up for on wineformalpeople.com, then you know the value of Patreon. I published in this edition of the newsletter a note that I received from somebody complaining that the back catalog had gone behind Patreon. And I explained why it is so difficult to provide these kinds of things for free. If you're interested in reading that, you can hit me up and I'm happy to send it to you. But it takes about 20 hours a week to produce the show, and I can't work for free. So Wine Access supports us on these 52 free shows, and the rest is supported by patrons, which I would encourage you to join. It's one of the cheapest subscriptions in wine, $21.60 for the year if you join for the year, or $2 a month. You can get the entire back catalog and support the work. Patreon.com/wineforNormalPeople. Another cool thing to do besides becoming part of this amazing, thriving community is take the Wine for Normal People classes. You can go to wineformnormalpeople.com/classes. Take Volcanic Wines on Saturday, Off the Beaten Path French, the Riesling class, Rosé class. Those are all live now. Make sure you sign up before they sell out. They are live classes, so I limit the number of people who are in the class so that we can have a good experience and everybody can get their questions answered. And of course, we need to thank Wine Access. If you are looking for a great way to get new wines, you have got to go to wineaccess.com/normal. This is the wine club that I have with Wine Access. Wine Access has a club discount that's available to anyone that is not currently a member. So if you were thinking about joining, you want to join, or maybe you want to gift a membership to somebody for Mother's Day, now is the time. This is a limited time offer. You can join the club and get $25 off your first two shipments. That's $50 we're giving you by going to wineaccess.com/normal. The discounts applied when your order is placed. 6 bottles, all hand selected by me and the Wine Access team. If you sign up now, you're going to get the next shipment, and that shipment focuses on Off the Beaten Path wines, and it includes some really interesting wines, including a Voskhat from Armenia, from Zulal, actually, episode 508. We also have a Valtellina, which is a Nebbiolo from Lombardy, which is very, very different from Piedmont. Where are you going to find these wines on your local shelves? You're not. So sign up for the wine club, and these shipments will come out quarterly. As a wine club member, you also get 10% off all other Wine Access purchases. This is such a great deal. Wine Access has been written up in publication for being a top wine club. These are affordable, amazing wines, and I know you're going to love them. Wineaccess.com/normal. $25 off your first two shipments. And now let's get back to the show.
By the middle to end of May, I'll go out and start to do suckering. I mean, by then, I think we've passed any of the frost concerns.
What's suckering?
Suckering. So the vines are always trying to, it's a preservation act on their part. They want to produce as much fruit as possible.
Yep.
And my job as the farmer is to control that. And in order to maintain quality and allow the vineyards to get ripe in time for us to harvest them. So suckering are all the extra shoots that the vine tries to put out. So even though I've cut my spur back to 2 buds, those 2 buds I want to grow into the 2 canes that will have the 2 clusters that we'll harvest at the end, it may throw on other buds in other places, whether it's on the trunk or underneath the cordon or next to those 2 buds that I've pruned back. It's early in the season. It's just easy to go in and you just knock them off of your finger.
Oh, wow.
But for me, I usually don't do that until flowering, because by then I'm fairly certain I'm not going to get a frost that's going to knock my buds off and make me sorry that I've already suckered, because then I've taken away my insurance policy, if you will. So that's probably the most intensive part of the early spring, is just suckering and making sure the shoots are growing in the right position. And as they get long enough, you'll start to do the positioning in the wires. So there's a wire that the cordon is attached to that supports that infrastructure piece. And then I have 2 different loops at different heights on the trellis system above that, that I can use to position my canes or shoots in. It supports the weight and allows me to kind of manage the sun exposure.
And sometimes you want to shade stuff, right? And sometimes you want it to have full sun exposure.
Yep. So I want to get in there before the vines get too big, just to make sure they're on the right side of that wire. Because if they're on the outside, then they don't have that support mechanism. And if you wait until they're too long, you can sometimes break the shoots as you try to get them under the wire.
Yikes. So yeah,
it's a timing thing.
What about shatter? Can you talk about shatter, or colure, as they call it?
Yeah.
Have you ever had that before, and what is it?
Sure.
And why is it so bad? People talk about it a lot. It's obviously a bigger problem in Europe because of the erratic weather, but talk about that.
Yeah, it's just a cluster that has lost either some of the flowers, or the fruit set didn't completely finish on that cluster. So it's a partially developed cluster, and it can happen because of strong winds or heavy rain or some other environmental condition that just caused that particular cluster not to fulfill its destiny, I guess. The grapes that are on that cluster can typically ripen normally and be utilized. And there's also a thing where some of the hard little green seeds that the grapes start out as, they just never flower, so they don't fully develop. It's a quantity issue at the time of harvest. You're going to have less crop to make wine with, and it's frustrating, but it doesn't happen too regularly for us, so it hasn't been a huge issue.
That issue, the hens and chicks issue that you're talking about with Collioure, is different from what Zinfandel has, right? Because doesn't Zinfandel have that just naturally, like some ripe stuff, some raisins, some, or is that the same thing?
We grow our Zinfandel on a trellis, on a wire, and Zinfandel is famous for being uneven in terms of ripening. And
Right.
that's a lot of the head prune vineyards from the old days have that. I mean, you've got clusters that are on the outside with lots of sun exposure, and clusters that are on the inside that have very little. They're very protected from wind and the sun and whatnot. So that unevenness is natural. And some people just say, oh, it'll all come out in the wash. You'll have some overripe stuff and some underripe stuff. And it's true. It's probably made some good wines, but we don't have that unevenness issue when we're growing them on a vine.
But Zinfandel, that issue is separate from Collioure. That's not the same thing as Shatter. I just want to be clear
Correct.
about that. All right, what's the worst thing that's ever happened early in the season in your vineyard, in your almost 20 years of owning it? Like, have you ever just looked at it and been like, oh God, what are we going to
I have not had a catastrophic event. I'll say
do?
that.
That's
And I'm going
amazing.
to
Do you
knock
know
on
anybody
wood.
that has around you?
Well, I mean, yeah, we've had some pretty substantial frosts or heavy late rains that, depending on where the vineyard is in its development stage, we're growing more later ripening grapes. We're surrounded by Pinot. Those vineyards go through bud break earlier, so they are more susceptible to those late winter environmental
Perils.
things
Yeah, and
than
they
we
also have
are.
thin skins and all of that. I mean, it's a lot. Pinot is really difficult in many ways, much harder than a lot of other grapes that are out there. All right, so we already talked about the vine growth and canopy management in June and how that's going to be. You're going to be doing a lot of training and wire training. You talked about Cordon, but what about Guillot? Like, what's the difference? Those are the two that people talk about all the time. If you did Guillot, what is the difference? Do you know what that's about? And like, what is it for? Why do people do different kinds of wire training?
I'm not even sure I know what Guillot is, but what I described was spur pruning. So we're pruning back to a spur. There's also what's known as cane pruning, where you're taking a new cane that grew last year and making that the cordon for this year. So it's a little more intense. It's maybe above my pay grade.
Super quick editor's note. Brian is talking about cane pruning, and that is Guillot. So we talked about Guillot pruning. This is what it is, cane pruning.
In terms of how to select the right cane. And it's a strategy against those prolonged diseases that happen in vineyards. And it's a technique that we don't use, but it's basically you create a new cordon every vintage.
That's a lot of work.
It seems like a lot of work, but I don't have any practice in it, so I can't say for sure.
But there's a lot of different ways, and I guess people just do whatever they think is going to be best for their particular
Yeah,
vine.
it's based on their grapes they're growing, what their goals are. I mean, where our winery is, we're out in the middle of a Sauvignon Blanc vineyard that's probably 30 or 40 years old, and their ultimate goal is to have massive crop loads. Where we have one fruit zone, they've got three different levels of fruit, and they're trying to farm in the 10 to 12 to 15 tons to the acre.
Oh
So it's
my
a lot of
gosh.
water, a lot of fertilizer, and just pretty intensive farming.
That seems like not great wine would result from that. No
And
offense
they
to
sell
them.
it to a big hulking winery. So
Oh, shocking. I
it's
wonder if I know
all.
who that is. I probably do. You've got this big canopy. So now, like, fast forward a month or a month and a half from now, how often do you have to go through and trim and remove leaves and do canopy management and then figure out the shading? Because you've already set stuff up for vertical shoot positioning. So you've done what you think is best, and then Mother Nature happens. So what do you do? And do you have to change course ever during canopy management? And how do you do canopy management? Or is it just vine by vine by vine?
Well, you're always looking at the weather. It's not that intensive in the summer months. I mean, my vineyard grows north south. So, like last year, we had a pretty cool growing season. Early August, the grapes are starting to go through veraison, and I usually do some leaf pulling at that point.
Explain what veraison is, please.
So, veraison is the point which the grapes start accumulating mass and they begin to accumulate sugar. So, for a red grape, it will start to turn color and go from these green berries to purple berries, or in the Grenache's case, more of a ruby berry. White grapes go from a hard green berry, they start to get a little more opaque, they turn golden or yellow and start to soften up as they accumulate sugar. The rule of thumb is that about 6 weeks after veraison is when you harvest the grapes. And there's so many things that impact that, mostly weather related. That's just a rule of thumb, not a guarantee by any means.
Most of summer, are you actively managing the canopy or you're just waiting for veraison?
I'm looking at the grapes all the time. I'm looking at the canopy. What are the leaves telling me? Do I need to add water? And I can do that on a vine by vine basis because I've set up a secondary drip system that I can add emitters to where I've got underperforming vines that I could water without watering everything.
That's amazing. What a great way to save water and do water management.
Right. Well, otherwise I'm out there with
Watering
a
can and
water
hose.
bucket. So, anyway, I leaf heavily on the eastern facing side, so the side that gets the morning sun.
Yep.
You want to leaf in the fruit zone so you've got airflow, which keeps the moisture at bay and some of the mold pressure. It's also much gentler sun in the morning. The west side, which gets the afternoon, the warmer sun, I usually don't do much leafing on. I mean, I remember back when we didn't know anything about farming, like in 2010 and 2011. Where we had cool vintages and we leafed the heck out of stuff with the intention of, oh, it needs more sunshine. And then you had a heat spike and we got sunburned. So
Oh.
you have to make decisions very cautiously and you don't want to overcompensate.
What would you have done differently in 2011? You just would have left more leaves on, or you would have, how would you have
Probably.
done it? Yeah.
Yeah,
Okay.
I would have been less aggressive in my leafing.
2011 was also really rainy.
At the wrong times. Yeah,
Right.
late into the spring and fairly early and in significant quantities in September.
Yes, I remember because I was there for harvest in 2011 and people were freaking out. I mean, just because it never rains in September. However, I will say that some really amazing wine was made that year because it
Oh.
was cool and kind of strange. And the best producers really made some interesting and delicious wines. They were a little bit more European in style, a lot more acidity for sure.
No, it's great. I mean, the vintage got panned, but the wines were fantastic. They were just much more nuanced and the wines I like to drink anyway. So the critics really threw 2011 under the bus, but incorrectly so.
As Taylor Swift likes to say, haters gonna hate, you know? Okay, so we skip. So you're doing canopy management, the fruit has set. What about green harvesting and things like that? You do that before the canopy gets big. When do you do that? Or when do you start dropping fruit? Tell us, like, why would you do that? Why do you drop fruit and when do you drop fruit? At what stages?
Yeah, there's a couple times that we will do a drop fruit pass. The way we're farming, we're trying to get two shoots per spur, and there's, 4 to 6 spurs on each end of the vine, and then two clusters on each of those shoots. So the vines will, again, try to set more fruit than we want. You've got your main fruit zone. You may get some secondary fruit that's up a little higher in the canopy. That again is, there's nothing wrong with it. There's a lot of second growth wineries that make beautiful wines off of those. But our goal is really just to have one pick. So we're trying to maintain a uniformity in the vineyard. So
Right.
we typically drop that secondary fruit pretty much as soon as it shows up, we'll take it out because it's taking away nutrients and some of the energy that the vines could be putting into the fruit we really want.
Right.
So that's one pass that we'll make is to drop any secondary fruit or any extra clusters that have appeared in the fruit zone.
What time of year is that?
Midsummer, early summer, June, somewhere in
Okay.
there. If we have a vine that isn't vigorous or a shoot that doesn't look weak, we might take one of those two clusters off to give that other cluster the best chance. We do a green drop. Usually it's about 90% into veraison, which is shows anything that's kind of behind schedule. either because it was one of those secondary shoots that set, or it's just not ripening along with the rest. So that's usually something we would do in late August, early September, again, depending on the vintage and the vineyard.
Do different grapes require different care? Your positioning is all the same, so your pruning is going to be about the same. But then once you start having fruit development, you were talking about it being staggered. Viognier and Mourvèdre are completely different. You got Mourvèdre. I mean, I remember our first underground wine event with you. You guys almost didn't make it because the Mourvèdre was ripe and it just got ripe right before. And so you were able to make it. But it was like that kind of thing has got to be all throughout the season. You're looking at, okay, Viognier is happening now, but Mourvèdre is a month behind, right? I mean, or
Well, and
2 months.
that works well for us. I mean, we can stagger our work.
Right. But then you're also working constantly from
There's
August through
always something to
November.
do. That's always
Yeah.
true.
So the decisions that you make, you have to change your mindset for each thing. So you're like, okay, here's the Viognier. This requires this. We know that this has to happen here. Grenache needs this. The Mourvèdre needs this. Syrah needs this. Each of them requires something different, right?
Yeah, and that's mostly about timing. I mean, it's
Okay.
basically the same process. You know, unless, again, we've never had a catastrophic event, but if we saw powdery mildew in something, then we have to react to that. But it's variations on a theme.
Rhythm. It's just this
Yeah.
rhythm that keeps going on and on and on. It's kind of nice, right?
Yeah.
So let's go back to Veresian. How long does it take for Veresian to happen? I mean, over the course of how many days or weeks does stuff start to turn from these disgusting hard berries that you would never eat to something that looks like something you might be able to make wine with? Is it all based on weather? When does Veresian happen? And it really is a very crucial point in the harvest. I mean, it's basically like the main event.
Yeah, it's the countdown to harvest, and it's 35 days to 45 days, somewhere in there after Veresian happens. And Veresian, it is all weather-based, basically, as to when it starts. And again, all the varietals are different, but it's 2 to 3 weeks from when we start Veresian, where you start to see the light pinkish color that shows up on the grapes into where it turns that deep purple that you're used to seeing from grape clusters.
Do you have any worries during Veresian, or is this a really exciting period? I mean, I feel like the whole thing is basically like having a baby. You're just sitting there the whole time worrying about all of these things. And am I doing the
That you
right
have no
thing?
control
Is this the
over.
right thing? Is this the right? And everybody has their own way of doing it.
Akin farming to gambling, it's all a crapshoot sometimes. I mean, Veresian is super exciting because you know harvest is coming. It's usually, you know, a spectacular time of year around here. The one thing that happened to us in 2020, we had some significant fires just west of here in August of 2020. Started from a lightning strike. We had a bizarre lightning storm, dry lightning in the middle of the summer, which, I mean, we don't get thunder and lightning in California very often. And it started a very large fire about 5 miles west of us. So it was a fire that went burned for a couple of weeks.
Right.
And it wasn't like immediately adjacent to our vineyards, but Veresian is kind of the point where the grapes are the most environmentally sensitive. We had major fires even a little closer in 2017 and 2019, but those happened in October, where we were through Veresian, a lot of the fruit was picked, and they weren't as susceptible to those environmental conditions. But we had the fire in August. That was the worst. I mean, we dumped a lot of fruit from that vintage because of smoke issues.
Yes, but you do remember all of those issues in Napa about people who made very expensive wines out of that bad fruit. And I believe, who was it? One of the very prominent winemakers quit a consulting gig
Oh,
because she's
Heidi Barrett.
Heidi Barrett, because she did not approve of them releasing the wine because it was all smoke taint. I mean, these decisions are not easy. And so, whereas Europe is mainly dealing with frost and rain and hail and things like that, now you are starting to deal with fire and conditions. I have a question that's kind of nerdy, and I'm going to ask it because you do work with Rhone varietals, and
Sure.
people have brought this up on the Patreon page, which Brian is a patron. So shout out to Brian.
Brian C.
Brian C, baby. All right. Lignification. So this is when the stems go woody and they turn brown. And some people say it never happens. Rhone producers say it does happen. People in California have said lignification never happens. The only reason I'm asking about it is because when you make wine, especially Rhone varietals, sometimes you do stem inclusion. And if you're going to do stem inclusion, those woody notes are better than some of the green notes that are in stems. Does it ever really happen?
It does. Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's what I thought. I know in Rhone, they say it happens every year.
I mean, it's the Grenache, no, but the only time we have done whole cluster fermentations is with Mourvedre. And again, that's the last one out in the vineyard. So lignification typically happens in the Mourved. And we are often just dealing with situations that are thrust upon us. In 2019, we brought in our Mourvedre on a day that our local power company decided to turn off the power because of high winds. So
wow.
They call them brownouts.
Yeah, great.
So we didn't have any equipment. So whole cluster it was. and it turned out great. It was fantastic. We loved it. And we've experimented with it subsequently. And again, it's situational. Next year, I think we did a third of the Mourvedre fully destemmed, one 50% whole cluster and the other one like 75% whole cluster, and maintained separate barrels of those to see how they went. And ultimately, we blended it all back together because we thought that was the best. But it was a good experiment to work with. But in those cases, when you're using whole cluster, the lignified stems provide a better outcome than the green stems.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I do adore about you is that you actually drink a lot of Rhone wines. There's a lot of people that make Rhone varietals or make Bordeaux varietals or make Pinot. They never drink Burgundy. They never drink, you know, Rhone. You actually do. So one of the more interesting things that I learned when I went to the Northern Rhone a couple of years ago is that they are using the stems to absorb alcohol, because the stems will, but they have to wait for them to get kind of woody. They reduce alcohol. The stems are sucking up some of the alcohol. So
in the fermentation?
Yes, in the fermentation. It's kind of an interesting thing, but they have always said that the stuff gets fully lignified. And my feeling was always that, yes, it doesn't happen with everything, but a lot of, especially the later ripening grapes, and Syrah would be a good candidate for that, especially in Rhone, in Northern Rhone, I should say. It will lignify, but we've had some debates on the page about that. So I just wanted to get that straight, that lignification is in fact possible, and that in winemaking, lignification doesn't really matter in the vineyard, but in winemaking, if you are going to use those clusters, lignification is important because, again, those Rhone producers talk about the Viognier and the Syrah, especially sucking up some of that alcohol, which is a real benefit these days. All right, here's my question. Harvest. Okay, so we've made it through. We're at Veragen. You're watching things. We're praying that the weather's good. We're praying that everything is okay. How sick of the vines are you by the end of harvest? Is it like having 3,000 children? Do you feel like you love these vines? You're proud of them. Do you have any vines that you're like, oh, you're such a good one? Like, I really love working with you. I mean, do you feel this emotional connection with your vineyard? You know it really well at this point. You've been working at it for 18 years. I'm sure you know every single vine. And some of them you're like, oh, this one's so frustrating.
In general, I mean, I don't have a direct relationship with each vine, but I do certainly on the vineyard as a whole. It is an anxious time. As you get close to harvest, I mean, the ripening of grapes is not a linear process. You know, you're not going to see a degree change in Brix in a way that can say, okay, in 10 days, we're going to harvest this vineyard. You know, we're out there every day or every other day as things get closer. We use mostly sensory. We're looking at the skins and tasting the seeds and the juice and looking at the pulp packet inside. We do test Brix. We do test pH.
And Brix is sugar content.
Brix is the sugar accumulation.
Might not know that yet.
But, you know, there's all sorts of people who are sending off to labs to test all sorts of things. And we don't tend to do that. I mean, Steve and I have always kind of flown by the seat of our pants in a way.
That's the natural way of doing things. That's traditional farming. But if there were ever a problem, would you send it out to a lab if you thought maybe there was something weird?
Yeah. I mean, that's our MO is don't do anything drastic unless you have to.
Yeah.
And that's true in the vineyard. It's true in the winery. It's true the whole way through.
And so when you're doing the measurement readings, you're really trusting, even if the measurements are different from what you feel from a sensory perspective, you're going to let your taste and your experience come first. What about at the beginning, though? Did you just only do it by the numbers?
To some degree, but I mean, we've never been running to the lab and getting all these tests done. That's how we taught ourselves. It was all about our palate and what we were tasting and experiencing. So we've been able to rely on that.
Awesome. As you're harvesting, do you do hand harvesting, all four of you, or do you do machine harvesting, or how do you do it all by hand?
No, I mean, the technology on the tractors has been substantially improved, but we just don't have space. We're not big enough.
Right.
I mean, for those mechanical harvesters, you have to have a big space for them to turn around. And we don't have that. I can barely get my tractor down my vine rows. And I've got lots of, we call it tractor blight, where we've run into the fences or whatever else we've damaged in the process of getting into the vineyards. So no, it's all hand harvested. That's how the small guys roll for the most part.
Is it really exhausting work?
You know, after a couple hours, I've, you know, can check that box every vintage and said, okay, well, we picked some grapes, and that's why we get the help. Well, plus picking the fruit is like 25% of the job. Then you have to go back to the winery and process it. So when we were picking it all and then taking it to the winery, we were bloody exhausted.
Yeah.
And now we're older, so we're looking for all the aids that we can bring in. So we have lots of friends who want to come and help us. And if you can spend a little time training them, I mean, we have been through the vineyard 100 times before we actually harvest it. So there's not much out there that has to be dealt with. You're just picking the fruit. It's fun. It's, you know, it's one of the more romantic things about winemaking is the day you're picking the fruit.
Do you pick it in the morning so it stays cool, or does it? Yes. Okay.
We typically start with headlights, you know, before even the sun comes up, and we try to get it off as soon as possible because that cold temperature will help the grapes. We don't have to go far, but the warmer they are, the more fragile they are. And we try to get them destemmed and into the wine cellar. We'll put them in the barrel room for a few days beforehand. And, you know, the must temperatures are still in the mid 50s usually by the time they get through our processing at the winery.
It's amazing, you know, when you think about like in Walla Walla in the Columbia Valley, they ship fruit 4 hours. Can you imagine picking it at 4 a.m. and then it's sitting in a truck for 4 hours? I mean, I think that would really make me stressed out. That's something I never really understood about Washington wine. It's
good
wine.
Or worse, they'll ship it across country and, you know, probably a refrigerated truck, but the compaction that happens and, you know,
fermentation starts. I mean, you can't stop it. Natural yeast on those grapes. So then harvest is done. We're not going to cover the winery piece now. We'll cover that in another show.
Yep.
And then what do you do? We've talked about some of the things that you do. You've made the wine. After the fruit is picked, you got to leave the vineyard for a while, right? You're gonna do some of the items that you talked about. And then...
Yeah, I'll put the water on it. We usually go out and compost, get the cover crop on just to button it up. And then we can pretty much December through February, we don't have to do anything.
It's pretty amazing. So that's our year in the vineyard. Did we leave anything out? Is there anything else that we forgot that you want to talk about?
I think we pretty much covered it. No, it's an amazing experience. And to have planted these vineyards ourselves and to have been able to make wine off them for so many years, we feel like we know what we're going to get. There's variations on that, but it's pretty consistent. And we love the quality of the fruit. And we thank our lucky stars for being able to do what we do.
And to be able to be doing it in a place where it's not yet so erratic that you're stressed out every year. I think if you were in Chablis, the story is a lot different. You ever read like about the vintage reports and just think, oh my gosh, what do you think when you read that?
Oh, I just feel like we're so lucky. I mean, even our friends who are winemakers who are growing grapes in different counties, they are in their car all during harvest. And I'm just like, no, thank you. We are about a very specific place, and we love that tight-knit focus. It's just really been one of our best decisions getting into this.
I think that small wineries everywhere, people that decide to stay small and that decide to focus on quality, have a very different life, don't they?
I think so.
Well, it's a good life. Brian, thank you so much for taking us through this year in the vineyard. I think it really speaks to this unwavering dedication to just being in nature all the time and watching and having some attunement that most of us don't have in our daily lives. It really must be very fulfilling to do this year after year after year.
It is, especially when you realize that Mother Nature's in charge and we are just a pawn in her game. So
yes, but you can work with her. She can be your friend. Isn't that nice?
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah, she's been very good to us.
Yes. So everybody, please check out cruxwinery.com. Check out Brian, and Steve is Brian's partner, and check out their wines. I know many of you have visited. You can go visit them in Sonoma. You can order their wines online. But what you will see across their line is that you can taste the vineyard. You can taste the terroir. This is the benefit of being able to do all of the things that Brian's talking about, because if we had this conversation with a very large winery, it would not be like this. It would be more like, and then we take a giant hedger and chop off the top of all of the leaves. And then we take a tractor, and if there's animals in it, we just chop them up. It's a very different thing. So this is, again, why we support small wineries. Thank you so much, Brian.
No, you're welcome, Elizabeth. Thank you.
And with that, this has been another episode of Wine for Normal People. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.